Barry Sandusky. NPR's Dave Mattingly has more on a report in the Wall Street Journal.
According to the Journal, the payments would total about $60 million, with the money used to settle 25 to 30 claims involving Sandusky. Penn State's trustees are said to have authorized the payments, with the claims to be settled within a month by the university's insurance company. Last year, Sandusky was convicted of sexually abusing 10 boys over 15 years, some of them on the Penn State campus. He was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison. Dave Mattingly, NPR News.
Stock prices are up, the Dow up 113 points. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon. Have you ever had a moment at work when you were so overwhelmed by how you felt about something that was happening personally or something that had happened in the office that it inhibited your ability to do your job well? Personally, I have to admit that there are topics I have a hard time reporting on, and as a member of the newsroom, I've done my share of laughing and crying during interviews. This hour on Focus, we're going to talk about those feelings and how they play a very real role in the workplace for doctors. I want to welcome Dr. Danielle Ofri to the show. She's author of many books about the world of medicine. Her newest title is What Doctors Feel: How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. In addition to her work as an author, she's also a practicing internist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Danielle Ofri, welcome to Focus.
Thank you so much.
So before I get started, I do want to let our listeners know that this is a pre-recorded episode of Focus, so we aren't taking calls this hour, but we would still love to hear from you. What are the most important qualities to you in a doctor? You can post comments to our Facebook page or find us on Twitter at Focus580. The premise of this book is that doctors have feelings, which of course is true, but when someone says the word doctor, that's not the first thing that comes to mind. Why has this idea developed that doctors are unfeeling in some way?
A part of it is the media portrayals of doctor. You know, mostly we see doctors as very rational, all-knowing, very paternalistic, but most of us know that isn't really the case. Certainly this has changed over time. There's also the expectation that doctors will give you the precise and correct right answer. But I think, you know, most patients, if you ask them, would you like to type in your symptoms into a computer and get a diagnosis? And you'd probably get a very accurate diagnosis. But most of us probably wouldn't choose that because although it might give us the right answer, I think we wouldn't feel as though we really were being taken care of. Most of us would prefer to have a human being take care of us, and human beings come stocked with emotions, and there's no way around it, even in the exam room.
In your book, there are some very real moments when emotions play a huge role in your own practice. Tell me about Julia.
Julia, or as she goes by, Julia. So Julia was a patient who I met when she was admitted to the hospital for congestive heart failure. And usually congestive heart failure is the purview of older patients, geriatric patients, but she was in her mid-30s, and her heart was failing for just bad genetic reasons. She had two young children, and at the time I was in my mid-30s, I also had two young children. And there was this moment about telling her the diagnosis. And it turned out that for a failing heart such as hers, there really was only one true treatment that could offer a cure, and that is a heart transplant. But of course, because she was an undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, she wouldn't be eligible for a heart transplant. So there was this moment when we had to tell her about this diagnosis. That was a very difficult moment. It was a little bit like looking in the mirror. We were both the same height and build, the same age, mid-30s, and both of us had two young children at home. In another world, had we been friends, we could have easily shared clothing. But today, it was me with the white coat and her with the death sentence. Except she didn't know it yet. It was the morning of Julia's discharge from the hospital, and we were going through the array of cardiac medications stacked on her bedside table. She asked me the same question about each bottle. Will this medicine make my heart better? I squirmed painfully around the question, weaving ever more elaborate explanations about controlling symptoms, enhancing breathing, minimizing fluid imbalances, improving exercise tolerance. I told every truth about every medication, but I could not bring myself to tell her the ultimate truth, that a roll of the genetic dice had doomed the fibrils of her heart, that her only chance was a heart transplant, that because she was an undocumented immigrant, this was nigh impossible, that her children would grow up motherless. When Julia walked out of our hospital without full knowledge of her prognosis, I had been derelict in my duty as her physician. I was fully aware that my job was to have open and honest communication with her in a patient-centered manner, but I couldn't. I couldn't bring myself to tell this young mother that she was going to die. It could be that I over-identified with my patient, or that I let my emotions get the better of me, or that I was an out-and-out wimp. No doubt all played some role, but I wasn't the only doctor who struggled with the truth. Everyone responsible for her care, intern, resident, medical attending, cardiology fellow, cardiology attending, independently fell short of the Charter on Medical Professionalism that lists honest communication with patients as a paramount ethical pillar. Young, old, male, female, touchy-feely, egotistical, blustery alike, not one of us could say those words to her face.
That's a passage in the book that's taken from an op-ed you published long before the book. What kind of reaction did you get when that article was originally published?
I had quite a lot of response, swift and furious. Many, many people excoriated me for not telling Julia the full truth of her diagnosis. The common refrain was that I had robbed her of time to process her diagnosis. And these critics were, of course, correct. I was wrong not to give her the full extent of her diagnosis. I did rob her of time, but I wrote about the moment to point out how much emotions play a role. And six or seven of us doctors all tried to tell her none of us could, and it took us till her outpatient visit some weeks later to break the final news. And I'm not proud of what happened, but it makes me give respect and acknowledgement that emotions will change how doctors practice medicine.
And was that a reality that you had encountered or something that you felt very strongly about before your encounter with her?
Well, I think that my encounter with her really brought it to the forefront. And in this book, I chose to weave her story throughout the entire book. I actually introduced her story in my previous book, Medicine and Translation, and this book now tells her story much more extensively over the course of 10 years, because her story really brought out every emotion, the gamut. We had so many years and so many ups and downs with her case, and I think that she really exemplified the fact that emotions exist. They're there in the room with us. They change how we behave, and if we ignore them, then we run the risk of not doing the best for our patients. And although I couldn't necessarily do the best for her at that moment, it did make me aware. And so when I saw her the next time, we were able to corral this and get past that difficult emotional blockage and share the truth with her.
Was there any consideration by anyone, the fact that you identified so closely with her as a patient, the fact that she had children, but there wasn't time for you as a person to process, you had to give someone that news?
I think there were definitely readers who realized that. And I think that might have been what was part of the issue. I think even the doctors who didn't have children or who weren't the same age also felt, I think maybe not even consciously, that they needed time to settle this in themselves before they could bring themselves to tell a 35-year-old woman she was doomed to die. And I think it points out that doctors themselves are not automatons, right? The computer could have spit out that prognosis, but real people, when faced with terrible, grievous news, they need time to process that. And maybe the reason none of us could say is that we needed time to get ourselves acquainted and accustomed and accepting of this before we could then bring ourselves to tell her. It's just a reality.
In the world of medicine, do you think there's enough attention paid to the fact that doctors also need time to process big news like that before they can deliver it well and appropriately to patients?
I think not. I think we have an expectation that doctors will be a direct conduit of any results and situations. And again, the computer can do that, but doctors are people and nurses are people. And I write a lot about oncologists who have been studied quite extensively because they deal with death and grief a lot. And in fact, the grief is overpowering in their lives. Despite being professionally trained to deal with it, many doctors find that the death of a patient affects how they behave with the next patient. If they thought maybe the patient died because they weren't aggressive enough, they often find themselves being overly aggressive with the next patient. And vice versa, if they felt the patient suffered unduly, they might find themselves being less aggressive with the next patient. And perhaps if they had some time or space to give that grief its due, they might be able to approach the next patient with a completely blank slate.
What happened to Julia?
Do you want me to share the whole story?
In the end, you describe in the book really moving mountains for her case. But she, sadly, it doesn't have a happy ending.
So Julia was a very, very special woman. Something about her, I think, inspired people. Sweet, unassuming, a hard worker, rigorous with her medications, and she did everything helping her children. But we had this issue with her being undocumented. As she began to go downhill, she remarried someone who did have a green card. And once that happened, the hospital kicked into gear like I've never seen before. People did move mountains to help her process Medicaid and insurance, get her on the list, and she finally got a heart transplant. And many people comment the book focuses mainly on negative emotions, but this is one case where there is joy in medicine. I would say that it was the happiest day of my professional life when I got the phone call that Julia received a heart. I remember bursting out of my office, dancing down the hall, grabbing everyone to tell that Julia got a heart, and I even called my editors and all my writing contacts who had known about her over the years. It was as though the miracle had finally come through. It was so exciting. Shortly thereafter, I was on the road giving some lectures, and about a week later, I got a call that Julia had suffered a serious stroke and that she was bleeding in her head and that she was on life support and that it was going to be turned off. And it felt like overnight the tables had turned on us. And I came right back to New York and went straight to her bedside. I remember seeing her there, unconscious. I could no longer talk with her, but it was clear that she wasn't going to survive, that her brain had been overwhelmed by the new heart and that she wasn't going to make it. And we sat together. I sat with her for quite some time. And I remember thinking, what is it that I tell someone? What do you say at the end, especially if someone can't talk back to you? And because I'd just been giving a lecture, I had the book, my book was my last book. And so I took the book and I read her the story that I'd written about her, about the diagnosis, the whole amount that we had been through together. And then I said goodbye to her, and then she died, and I went to her funeral. And then it was going from the most joy that I've had in my career to perhaps one of the saddest days of my life, that this, you know, lovely young woman wasn't able to make it.
Did that affect how you approached other patients that you came into contact with after her death?
Whenever there's a death, I think we're all a little bit gun-shy about investing again emotionally. It's as though you've had a marriage or relationship and you've lost that partner, that it makes you a little bit hesitant. I remember going to see the next patient the next day and thinking, oh, can I do this again? Can I become so close to a patient? What if this patient is going to die after we spend all these years together investing in each other's lives? It's a very hard thing, and I do think it affected me, and I had to really be conscious that this was affecting me to not let it get in the way. But if I didn't remain conscious, it certainly might have.
So how you felt about her played a huge role in her care. And you describe her as being really wonderful to interact with and work with. But I do also want to talk about patients that are maybe not so easy to like. How do you handle dealing with difficult patients? You describe many examples in the book about being in the ER and being frustrated with return patients who just don't seem to care about their own health.
It's very interesting. I've often watched students and interns who are otherwise very compassionate, empathic people, but when it comes to patients with what appear to be self-inflicted injuries, drug addiction, alcoholism, obesity, even those wonderful doctors, I see them change, and they become angry at these patients. These patients come and take up your time. They don't help themselves get better. They go right back to their, maladaptive behavior. And I see otherwise compassionate nurses and doctors really lose their ability to be empathic. And that's something we need to pay attention to. If we ignore that, then we're doing these patients a disservice. Because a patient's illness is a patient's illness, no matter how it came to be. This is our job as professionals. We take care of all of our patients. I wrote about one patient. I called him Mr. Corello, who was a drug addict. And he was admitted to the hospital for maybe the 60th time. And my team was just, rolling their eyes on another admission by the same drug addict, and nothing's going to change. And normally we, on attending rounds, on our daily teaching rounds, we pick the most interesting case to discuss or the most unusual case or the sickest patient. But that day, I said, let's go discuss Mr. Corello, who was really the most boring patient on the service. But we went to the bedside and spoke to him, and he was exactly as you'd expect, kind of disheveled and glassy-eyed and grunted mainly one-word answers. And he had the same bleak tableau of addiction, prison terms and methadone regimens and various encounters with the law and blackouts, and I could see that this was going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then that question dawned on me. I said to him, can you tell us, Mr. Corello, the precise moment you knew you were addicted? I said, we doctors, we see patients when they have their disease. We sometimes see them when they're healthy at checkups. But we rarely are there at the moment of transition. Could you take us there? And he looked at me and said, yes, I can. There was an exact moment. And he told the story of driving up the Henry Hudson Parkway in Manhattan, going to see his brother for his nephew's birthday party, excited to go there, and all of a sudden, he wanted a hit. He knew that he needed it, and he turned the car around and started going downtown again back to his dealer. And he said, it felt like God reached down a finger and flicked my car in the other direction, and I've been going downhill ever since. And when he told that story, the room was silent. The entire team was riveted by the specificity of this moment. And I think all of us could suddenly feel what it might be like to have these mysterious and inexorable forces overtaking our life. And after that, nobody rolled their eyes. Nobody made disparaging comments. Our interactions were much smoother with him. And I think he gave us this little bit of empathy, this window into his world that we could really see what it might be like. Whereas before we look at drug addiction, that's what happens to other people. But now he gave us a sense of what it might be like for us. And I didn't have any illusions it would suddenly cure his addiction. But it's hard to imagine that his addiction would have any chance of remitting without his doctors being able to feel true empathy for him.
I'm really interested in how you handle moral judgments. So people who do have who are drug users and have problems with that and continually return, dealing with insurance for people who are uninsured or dealing with payment for people who are uninsured is so complicated. In that scenario, you really made him a person to everyone who was involved with his team. How do you handle not making moral judgments and separating what you feel about a patient's decisions versus what they need to do for their care?
Partly that's constantly keeping in mind the issue of professionalism, that you're not going to the bedside as a lawyer or a business person or an accountant. You're going there as a caregiver, and that you have a different agenda, and that you have to try your hardest to put those aside and be aware of your own biases. I mean, it's unrealistic to expect doctors to have no biases, but I think we have to be cognizant of them, to know that we have a bias against people who seem to be self-inflicting their wounds and try our hardest to put that aside and find the spark of humanity in everyone. I mean, that we can do. You know, we can't solve, you know, the woes of addiction. We can't solve, you know, all the health care insurance issues. We can't solve poverty, crime, things that really affect our patients' health. But we can hold ourselves to the ideal of finding the spark of humanity in every person, because it's there, and it may be harder to find or harder for us to get there. And it's really our job, especially those of us who are teaching the next generation, to really show that. And sometimes when I'm really stuck, I'm with my team of students and we're with a patient who's very surly or uncooperative or seems a very unappealing alcohol, you know, drug addict type of person, and we're getting nowhere, I may ask, what's your hobby? What do you like to do? Or, you know, what did you used to like to do, you know, before you had alcoholism overtaking your life? And, you know, everyone has something they love to do. Even if they don't do it now in the condition their life is in, there was a point in their life that they had something that they were passionate about. Even the guy on the Bowery, you know, the most difficult or unfriendly person can tell you what they really were passionate about. And I find once you get someone talking about what is important to them, they come alive as a person, to us, the doctors, but also to themselves. I think they see themselves as having something valuable to share in this conversation. It's not always easy, but I think that that is really our job. And when we say what it means to be professional in medicine, I think that is it.
Dealing with difficult patients is one thing. Dealing with dying patients is a complete different issue. You paint a very vivid picture about how dealing with both types of people day in and day out, especially in an emergency room setting, is very challenging. Will you tell me the story about Eva and the newborn?
So Eva is the pseudonym of a pediatrician I spoke to, and she shared a harrowing story from her residency where she was an intern, kind of fresh off the boat, and she was called to a delivery where a very young set of parents, teenagers, were giving birth to a baby with severe malformations that was not compatible with life, and that the baby would die of asphyxiation. There was no treatment. The parents had been informed that the baby would look awful, and they had decided they did not want to see the baby. So when the baby was born, it was handed off to Eva and her resident. They were told to take the baby out of the room. So they whisked this baby away, and it was late at night, and there were no free rooms to examine the baby, and Eva and her resident ended up in a supply closet, the only place they could go. And the resident said, well, just make sure you record the time of death, and he left. And now she's alone with a baby who is going to die. And she remembers looking at the baby, and when you're waiting for a baby to die, it takes a very, very long time. And you wait for the breathing to slow down and the heart. And she's looking at this terribly malformed baby, thinking, this baby was never going to be held by its parents. No one was ever going to love the baby. And she was supposed to keep the baby unwrapped so she could watch the umbilical cord, because the pulsations of the umbilical cord, when they died out, that would be the time of death. But she was overcome by this emotion. She wrapped the baby up, held the baby in her arms, and just rocked the baby, saying, I love you, baby, I love you. Until the baby died. And then she came out of the supply closet with this dead baby in her arms and was told it was time for her, she had to find the morgue to bring the baby. And she was so affected by that. But there was no place to talk about that. Because as soon as she had the baby delivered to the morgue, there were new admissions and new sick children to take care of. And she never had time to really talk about that. Nobody did. And it was years later that she had what was really a post-traumatic stress disorder reaction while at a movie theater, watching a movie which showed a child drowning. And she suddenly had the same reaction that veterans of war have, where your heart starts to race and your mind is flooded with images, and you'd be overcome with a panic, and everything came back at that moment. And I think that if she had been in a more caring environment where someone would say, hey, you just dealt with one of the most traumatic things known to humankind. We need a moment to acknowledge that, to give you space to release that, to talk about it. She might not have had that terrible reaction years later.
As I was reading that portion of the book, I was tearing. It was really difficult to get through. How common is an experience like that for medical residents and interns?
I think, thankfully, rare, and rarer now. I mean, she trained 2 or 3 decades ago. I think now there is much more attention to the fact that many experiences that students and interns face are very traumatic. Dealing with death and infirmity, illness, powerlessness. And remember, these trainees are young. They're in their early 20s. Most have had very few life experiences. Many have never faced death before. And I think we realize now that we have to pay attention to this, that we have to be keeping our eyes out for traumatic and stressful situations and making a time and a place to acknowledge that. And I think if we don't, then we'd run the risk of people becoming embittered, who bottle their emotions up, who may later on have terrible reactions. So I think it's less common now, thankfully.
You mentioned in the book, doctors and physicians, people who work in the medical field, are mostly pull yourself up by your bootstraps and handle it type of people. Is there resistance to incorporating situations in which people can talk about things like what happened to Eva?
Absolutely. When I was in training, we had touchy-feely rounds. And of course, it wasn't called that. It was called something else. But they sent in a very well-meaning social worker to sit with the team and talk about things that happened that week. But because they sent in this kindly older social worker, and we called it touchy-feely rounds, everyone thought it was ridiculous and silly, and no one took it seriously. Whereas when your own attending, your supervising doctor, in their white coat, acknowledges this as a reality, that's different, because those are our real, we saw them as our real leaders. And so when my own supervisor would say, wow, that was such a sad situation that happened, I need a moment to give that space, then the team looks at their supervisor and says, you're right, that is really sad. So I think that we are much more able to see it from our own leaders in their white coats rather than having something tacked on, here's your moment to be touchy-feely. I think as we go about our daily lives, it's really our role models who walk the walk rather than talk the talk, who show us what it's like to acknowledge grief in the moment, to be there. I had a time when I was with my team and we were talking with a family about the family member was dying of cancer. It was clear they were not going to be cured. So we're talking about do not resuscitate and shifting the goals of care from cure toward palliation to symptom relief. And it was incredibly sad. And I remember that I began to tear up in the room a little bit. And later my intern said to me that she was so relieved that I began to, that I was showing it because she was so afraid she'd burst into tears. And she was, that I was tearing up first made her feel like, oh, it's okay to be sad, that this really was sad. And how could you not be sad? Someone was about to die, and the whole family was there. And it was, if you didn't feel sad, then you've lost something in you. So I think it's really who are in the leadership positions that have to acknowledge when emotions are real. It really does happen.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and this hour on Focus, I'm talking with Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's a practicing internist and author of the new book, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. This is Focus on WILL AM 580.
Comics tend to be funniest about the subjects they know best.
This is my anxiety song. If I keep the kitchen floor clean, no one will die.
Maria Bamford is oddly hilarious about having OCD, bipolar disorder, and suicidal thoughts. She has a new CD and is our guest on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County. Featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
We're back on Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon, and this hour I'm talking with Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's author of several books about the world of medicine. Her newest that we're discussing today on the show is called What Doctors Feel: How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. This is a pre-recorded episode of Focus, so we aren't taking live calls this hour, but we do welcome your feedback and questions online. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Danielle, before the break, we were talking about grief and sadness. I also want to talk about fear and how that plays a role in doctors' lives. What are the things you're most afraid of?
Well, I think we're all afraid of killing our patients or otherwise maiming or harming them. And it's a primal fear, and I don't think it ever goes away. I think as we get better and more experienced, the fear resides a bit in its potency, but it's always there a little bit. And honestly, I think it should be. I mean, if you're not a little bit afraid, then I think you're missing something, because you should be afraid when you approach a patient with a needle or a scalpel or a medication with strong side effects. I mean, you could really harm someone. I think we all need an appropriate dose of fear and awe and humility about what it is we do. You know, our risks are not losing money. Our risks are really harming another human being. And the trick is, you know, how do we keep the fear from overwhelming ourselves, and to keep it in a compartment that is not too walled off, but not overwhelming us with our day-to-day action. And I remember in training, there were many times that I felt very overwhelmed by fear. And I also learned that when you are, because it will happen sometimes, it's also okay to turn to a colleague and say, you know what, I can't do this now. Could you step in for me? I'm just, you know, overcome by fear, rather than faking it, which I think many people try and do, pretend you're not afraid. And I think people who pretend they're not afraid when they are become cavalier and become dangerous. So, again, it's more of a question of being aware of having it on your radar that you know when it's reached a proportion that's too much, how to get help and how to help yourself find the right balance.
Fear, you know, of hurting a patient, I'm really, you know, I hope that every doctor that I ever see has that as a thing. But I also, you write a little bit about the cost of defensive medicine, about doctors who have been burned by malpractice lawsuits. How does the fear of that affect the way certain physicians will practice?
I think many physicians, you know, realistically are afraid of malpractice. And because, you know, a single malpractice suit can destroy someone's life and their livelihood. And so they're rightly afraid, particularly in certain fields, neurosurgery, obstetrics, that have very, very high malpractice rates. And defensive medicine is one of the largest, most consequential outcomes of that. And this directly harms patients because doctors overorder tests. And besides the cost, there's also the risks of these tests, the increased chance of finding an incidental finding, something clinically meaningless, but then we do more tests to work that up and have more invasive tests and risks. Also, many doctors will decline to take patients with complex medical issues or patients who seem like they're the litigious type. And for patients who have complex medical issues, they have many fewer options. Then there's the other part of the coin, how doctors react emotionally to malpractice. And I think for many doctors, being sued, it's like having a death in the family. And I think doctors end up mourning or grieving for the doctor they used to be, the doctor who thought, if I did the right thing, I'll be okay. Many doctors won't be so comfortable investing themselves personally with patients. They don't want to get burned again. They just want to order a ton of tests, not get invested, and, you know, make sure they cover themselves with plenty of CAT scans and blood tests.
How often does that happen, that a doctor will get burned by a litigious patient?
Well, the majority of doctors will be sued at some point. And it obviously depends how far the lawsuit goes. Many suits settle out of court. Many don't, you know, the charges often are dropped. But for the patient, so the doctor for whom it goes to trial, this can, you know, extend for years and really disrupt lives, their own lives, their other patients' lives. I think it's quite common. I think it's also quite insidious. I think many doctors aren't consciously aware of ordering more tests. You might be in the spot, oh, the patient comes in with a headache. You know, I'm pretty sure it's nothing, but I better order a CAT scan, because what if they sue me later? I want to make sure I've covered myself. And so I think we do that unconsciously when in another time or another year, we might say, you know what, I'm quite confident it's not anything serious. You know, you can just take some Tylenol. I think we don't even realize that we do that.
Sometimes, you know, lawsuits are unwarranted. Sometimes they are because of actual mistakes. Just like anybody else, doctors are prone to making more mistakes when they're tired or under a lot of stress. And you talk about how that is a big problem, with especially with interns and medical residents being able to get enough sleep. How does that affect how you function in a clinical setting?
Well, it's interesting. We know that lack of sleep affects us in terms of reaction time and quickness of thinking. In particular, it's interesting because when you're overtired but an emergency comes up, most of us, the adrenaline can get us, you know, in the moment and we're great for that moment. But where it really affects us is when we're making complex, multifaceted decisions, which is really most of medicine. It's much harder to focus on multiple things when you're tired. The other thing that fatigue does, and you'll see this with little children, is it decreases your emotional resilience. Right? Little kids, when they don't get enough sleep, they become cranky, and adults do too. We express it differently, but we have much less reserve. So a small thing that wouldn't normally bother you will now set people off. You know, a comment from a nurse, a comment from a patient, and someone, you know, loses their cool, and that's when things escalate out of control. So not having enough sleep is a disaster, you know, all around. And so we've been trying many different things, limiting hours that residents can work, although it's not clear that that's the complete answer, because although the hours they have have twice as much as they used to have in there. But it's clear that at a bare minimum, people need to get a good night of sleep, and I would never want a doctor taking care of me who hadn't slept a reasonable amount of time.
Is the lack of sleep that certain doctors get at different points in their career because of the way that schedule is regimented when you're training, or do we just not have enough doctors?
Well, certainly it was related to the schedule. When we used to do, you know, every third night overnight, you would never get enough sleep. So we've changed from that model, so we're able to get more sleep, although still not quite as much, I think, as we want. But it's clear that we don't have enough doctors, especially in areas like primary care, general doctors. We have such a waiting list of patients, you know, wanting appointments for general medical care. So your hours that you are at the hospital feel twice as jam-packed as they used to be. Many more patients to see, many more things to deal with. And so I think it's a combination of both of those, yes.
We've heard a lot lately about the increased demand for primary care doctors, especially with insurance plans that say that in order to see a specialist, you must go through a primary care physician. So those doctors are working more and more hours and seeing more and more patients. You write about how burnout is a growing problem. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I think burnout, especially in primary care, is an enormous issue because, as you rightly said, primary care doctors, pediatricians and internists and family doctors, they have to take everything. And although they're often referred to as the gatekeepers, often they feel like the dumpsters of medicine. You know, I'll get a patient who's seen by a specialist and the patient mentioned a problem. Specialist doesn't want to deal with it, back to your primary care doctor. Whatever it is, the primary care doctor has to take everything. You can't, there's no line drawing where a specialist can say, oh, you know, I draw my line at the colon. After that, you know, you go back to your primary doctor. Which in some ways is a real honor. I want to be the doctor who takes care of my whole patient, but sometimes it can be overwhelming. You know, I have the same 15, 20 minutes as everyone else, and my patient will have, you know, 20 things that need to be dealt with. Plus, there are psychosocial issues, you know, dealing with poverty or dealing with insurance issues or stress with their family, things that will come up. All of these things are legitimate parts of primary care visits, and it can be a lot, and many people are exhausted physically but also emotionally in doing primary care medicine and long for the simplicity, I'll put that in quotes, of specialists who just have to deal with one organ system and nothing else.
How does how much paperwork you have to do affect burnout?
I think it's one of the largest issues. I think increasingly the amount of paperwork, it's going up exponentially. You know, I can give an example of the electronic medical record system that we now have and most hospitals have. I mean, it's great. It keeps everything legible. But one way the administration can add on new mandates is by making more required fields. So you can't close your visit until you've now addressed and all. Keep adding things, depression screening, pain scores, education level of patient. And they keep adding more and more things to do, all of which are important and valid, but the number keeps going up and you don't have any more time. And it becomes very frustrating. You want to focus on one thing, but you're forced to do more paperwork, or the patient has an insurance problem and the, you know, this medication is not covered. Well, you have to get a prior authorization. Who does that? The primary care doctor. And so it's everywhere you turn, it feels like there's more and more paperwork. And most doctors, they just want to be with their patients. They don't want to be doing paperwork. And when you compare other healthcare systems, for example, in Canada, they do much less paperwork because there's, you know, really one insurer for the whole province. Whereas now every patient has a different plan. I have to remember, well, which plan covers what? I can't remember. Whose formulary covers which medication? It's very hard to keep track.
As paperwork becomes a bigger thing, you mentioned more and more clinics and hospitals are using computerized technology. I've had a couple of appointments where I've been in a situation where there's been a computer in the room. I've been sitting on an exam table, and the doctor has asked me questions with his or her back to me and has been typing into the computer. In that sort of situation, is it appropriate to ask, you know, can we talk and you can do that later? It's a situation in which you want to be understanding of the time that's dedicated there, but how would you handle that as a patient?
It's a very hard thing. As a doctor, I'm torn because I also know if I don't type during my visit, there's no time at the end allotted, so I have to get through it. So my recommendation to doctors, and often interns will ask, well, how do you get by that? For the first 5 minutes, don't write. Just look at the patient, get the initial part of what's on their mind with direct eye contact. And for most people, if you have a really intense five-minute direct conversation, it really establishes you're paying attention. And then I'll say, you know, I want to get down everything you're telling me. Do you mind if I write while you speak? And so I acknowledge the computer. I ask their permission. I've spent the first part of the visit not writing. And then I find most patients are understanding because they know that there's only a certain number of hours in the day to do that. But I think if a doctor doesn't look up once, I think it's absolutely right to say, you know, hey, can we talk for 5 minutes first without the computer? I mean, it's rude, but it's very demeaning, and I would be very insulted if someone I was seeing as my doctor didn't look at me once directly.
There are several times in this book that you give examples of doctors, including yourself, making really big mistakes. Mistakes that have really poor outcomes. People die. What kind of feedback have you had from your patients? Did that scare anybody away?
I would say for my particular patient population, who largely is an immigrant, non-English-speaking population, no one knows that I'm a writer. So I think my patients, very few have seen my writing. But the few who have actually been very supportive. They really appreciate the honesty because they know that mistakes happen. You know, nobody thinks that it doesn't happen. And I find that patients, you know, nearly 100% would rather hear about it, honestly, with all its warts, than not hear about it. At least when they hear about it, then they can feel, all right, you know, I can trust you, because if you'll be honest about it, then I don't have to worry as much. They're more worried about mistakes happening and never being told. So mostly my patients are incredibly supportive because they know it's happening and they'd rather know about it than not know about it.
How hard was it to write about those, honestly? I mean, it's hard for anybody to admit they made a mistake. It's hard to make an apology. What was that process like for you?
Very, very difficult. You know, I wrote about a couple mistakes, but one of the ones when I was a second-year resident, I had a patient with severe diabetes in nearly comatose. And one of the things you do is you give them an insulin drip to control their sugar. And when he was kind of got back to normal, I turned off the drip. And the nurse said to me, do you want to give a shot of long-acting insulin before you turn off the drip? I said, why would I want to do that? I turned to my intern with his teaching moment, and of course I was wrong. I completely forgot the thing you're supposed to do is give an injection of long-acting insulin before you stop the drip. And the patient went back into a comatose state, and very quickly the senior resident found out and came down. And I remember her yelling at me in front of the whole emergency room about my error. It was the most humiliating moment of my life. And it was so embarrassing, and I had my team in front of me. It took me, you know, more than 20 years to write about that because of the shame and humiliation of the error. And it made me think that if I hadn't been so shamed and humiliated, maybe I could have come forward to the patient. I never told the patient that I'd made a mistake. I never went to him and said, you know, I did something wrong. I put your life at risk. You know, you could have died. I made you stay in the hospital longer. I just wanted to run and hide. And so it's really taught me the lesson of trying to take the shame and humiliation part out of it so people can come forward with their errors. Otherwise, we'll never know about them.
How is it in that setting to have your confidence shaken? I mean, before you go on the air and radio and you're live, if somebody makes a comment about your delivery or something, it's really unsettling to say, okay, now I'm going to have to do this. In medicine, that is just, there's so much more pressure there.
It's very hard. And for me, my confidence was shaken for quite some time. And where I see help with that is when I hear a supervisor, a superior, talk about their error and say, and I once heard a chief of service talk about their error at a, you know, in a public forum and talked about how it was one of the hardest moments of his professional life. And having this very high up person talk about how hard that moment was, yet see him still be a competent doctor, still in charge, still practicing, it helped me see that you can get through it. And his admission of his own error was so meaningful for me because he was, you know, many steps ahead of me in the training process. And that's part of how we get through it. We see others get through it. And then there's also talking to patients. And as I've gotten a bit older and more far along in my career, I have spoken to patients. I read about one patient who I advise him to do a medical procedure to get an implantable defibrillator. And things went horribly wrong. He had terrible, terrible outcomes, set him back a year in his life. And I felt so awful because I had given him this advice. But I spoke to him, and the process of talking was so helpful for him and for me. And we were able to dissect together the difference between true mistakes, bad outcomes, difficult judgments, and it helped him. And it really helped me. I think if I hadn't spoken to him, I would have harbored this terrible, terrible guilt. And he helped me ease my own guilt and continue practicing medicine.
Switching gears entirely, you play the cello.
Yes.
Tell me about your practice of the cello. And there's a reason that's actually really relevant for why you started playing. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So 7 years ago, I took a sabbatical to write a book. We were in Costa Rica, and my 4-year-old daughter was going to start violin the following year in our kindergarten in New York, and so we started lessons there. And I asked the teacher, how do you get a kid to practice? She's particularly strong-willed, thinking she was going to say sticker charts or M&Ms. She said, oh, seeing a parent practice. Like, okay, so I went out, bought a cheap cello, and took cello lessons. I'd be on the next instrument over, and I fell in love. And when I got back to my real life post-sabbatical, I knew I had no time, but I found a wonderful teacher and continued to this day. In fact, I had my lesson yesterday. And what's so exciting about that is when I was a medical student, the learning curve was uphill the whole way in an exciting way. Every day I learned more and more and more. But as I've, you know, come along in my profession as a doctor, the learning curve flattens out a bit. I mean, I'm still learning, but in more subtle ways, and it's not quite as dynamic. But in music, I'm certainly on the uphill part, and I find it incredibly stimulating, very joyful. It's also a way, when the emotions of medicine become overwhelming, it's a way to focus on something different. The music is very emotional. I've been working on a piece by Brahms the last few months, which is very heavy and intense. But when there are moments in the hospital of stress or sadness, to then be part of this incredibly emotional music is a way to help that emotion just play itself out and get to a better spot. It doesn't solve the problem or change the reality, but it allows it to smooth itself out.
It seems like you kind of make an argument that if all doctors had the time to have a really great hobby that could keep them intellectually stimulated in addition to being able to have a little bit more control over their work-life balance, that we might have a lot of better doctors. Has anybody challenged you on that?
People certainly have. Well, I think most people who do still say on the side, you know, but I wish I had time to do my hobby. So I don't think it would harm doctors if we all had an outlet for our passions and a place to build up our lives. I think most people would like control. I don't think anyone, or even me, thinks it's the answer. But I think most of us find that it certainly helps to have a place to have control in your life and to have an outlet.
A lot of this book, I think, is really enlightening as far as understanding the perspective of being a doctor. It's a very, you know, it's a minority of people who go to medical school and are a part of that world at some point. From this book, what is the takeaway for patients?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the doctor-patient connection is fundamentally a human one. It's not, you're not going to the car repair shop to get your carburetor tuned up. You're going to get yourself taken care of, and that's very different. And I, for better and for worse, but I think ultimately for the better, I think that the human connection plays an enormous role in how we get better, how we heal. And it's also not just one moment in time. You hopefully can have a longer-term relationship with your doctor so that there's a chance to go back and see other you know, other aspects of your life. So I think my take-home message is that emotions are part of every human interaction, and a doctor-patient interaction is no different. Whether you believe in it or not, emotions will be there, like the underlying, you know, baseline in a band, and that we need to be aware of that. So if something feels off or odd, it might be, and you can ask about that. And if you're not comfortable asking your doctor directly, you can talk to the nurse afterward or the practice manager if your doctor seemed, for example, preoccupied or not really paying attention. Maybe it's not the right doctor. I mean, you really need to get a good feeling as a person that this doctor is listening to you, sees you as a person, and is making a connection.
Danielle, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm Lindsay Moon, and this hour on Focus, I talked with Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's author of several books about the world of medicine. Her newest is called What Doctors Feel: How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. You can find out more about her and her book on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus, where you can also find our free downloadable podcast. We always welcome your feedback about the show and would love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Jason Croft is our technical director. You've been listening to Focus on WILL AM 580. We're here weekday mornings at 10 a.m. I'm Lindsay Moon. Thanks for joining us.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM. Their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
And at 10:58, I'm Jeff Bossert with a look at the markets. Right now on the commodities trade, winter wheat for December out of Kansas City, 7.20¾. That's up 1¾. December wheat out of Chicago, 6.76¾, down 1. December corn, 4.96¾, down 5¼. January beans, 12.68½, down 20. August bean meal, 4.65.60, down 3.50. August bean oil, 45.72, down 7 cents. August live cattle, 122.45, that's up 1½. August feeder cattle, 152.17½, up 120. August lean hogs, 96.70, up 90. In the forecast for Champaign-Urbana, the rest of today we're becoming hot and humid once again, becoming partly sunny skies, the high 92 degrees. Heat index readings today, 99 to 104. We're already at 88 degrees on Friends Plaza. Mostly clear tonight, the low 72 degrees. Hot and humid tomorrow, mostly sunny, the high 95 degrees. That brings us a heat index of 102 to 107. Friday night, mostly cloudy skies. A 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low 72 degrees, winds up to 15 miles an hour. Mostly sunny skies Saturday, but a 40% chance of showers, the high 85. And partly cloudy skies Saturday night and Sunday, the low 65, the high 82 degrees. Mostly cloudy skies Sunday night through Wednesday, a chance of rain, the low 68, the high 85 degrees. Again, 88 degrees on Friends Plaza in Urbana. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Coming up at 11 o'clock, we'll have NPR News and Fresh Air. Stay tuned.
From WHY.